Leaders like Gayla Hossett say these battles never seem to end.
We're oftentimes repeating ourselves over and over.
This time, Native groups are facing off against one of the most powerful sport hunting advocacy groups in the nation, which seeks to overturn Biden administration policies that added three tribally nominated seats to the Federal Subsistence Board. The Safari Club also wants to remove three other public seats and return the board to its original makeup, limited to the heads of five federal agencies.
It's a revolving door of these regional administrators that come through our state and that are here for a time, and they're making management decisions, not really knowing being on the land.
As a senior advisor to Interior Secretary Deb Haaland during the Biden administration, Raina Thiel shepherded the process of adding the additional tribal seats. Although it took about 3.5 years to get them in place, Thiel says it was worth the effort. Along the way, tribal leaders introduced many ideas on how to improve subsistence management on federal lands.
Nobody really lives the way we live in Alaska. It's an incredibly unique system. And so folks just don't have the context or the history with it to really understand it.
The Safari Club has also called on federal managers to defer to the state when overseeing wildlife on federal land. But opponents say that conflicts with a 1980 law which gives rural Alaskans priority for hunting and fishing on federal lands.
The word deference means consideration. It's not a mandate.
John Sturgeon, a longtime Alaska Safari Club policymaker, says the group does not oppose rural priority.
We're not asking for that. We're saying that they have to listen to Fish and Game, and we don't think they've been doing that over the years.
Alaska's dual management system for state and federal lands has spawned many a battle over the right to hunt and fish, and this one could be the start of another long fight. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And I'm Jill Freitas.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Althea Billings, Isabel Charlet, and Suzanne Potter. The producer is Annette Newell and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, up next.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Portland City Councilors passed an ordinance at their meeting this afternoon to use the city attorney's office to defend city workers against retaliatory legal proceedings brought by the federal government. Councilor Eric Zimmerman brought the policy forward. In their meeting this afternoon, Zimmerman said federal investigations into the mayor of Minneapolis and a new possible investigation into New York Attorney General Letitia James made the code change more urgent for him.
Colleagues, we're living in pretty uncertain times when it comes to the rule of law and the interactions between different levels of government. We've all felt on some level the pressure and the rhetoric coming from the federal administration with respect to local and state leaders complying with federal demands, and sometimes those have been at odds with state law. It is not unusual for different governments to have competing laws. And in large parts, those points of friction have a long history of being worked out in our courts, exactly as they should be. In those instances, we see the respect for the system, respect for the different appointed or elected officials, offices held, excuse me, and a reliance and a deference to a system of laws, debates, and legal proceedings. What that system has aimed to protect for 250 years is that we do have a system of multiple governments here. We are not one government centralized at the federal level with a supreme leader. We are not subservient. We are independent, and we are accountable to the laws and the regulations, not just at the federal level, but also within our own state and within our own local jurisdiction. Last summer, we began hearing rhetoric from the president and his advisors about charging local officials who they deemed to be preventing the federal government from doing their job, that by simply not helping with immigration enforcement, one was actually hindering or preventing the federal government from doing their job, irrespective of local laws that prevent local officials from certain actions. This is a wild escalation, but for much of the summer and fall, it seemed to be threats through rhetoric. And then that really changed. That changed in January of this year when the Federal Department of Justice convened a grand jury to look at the governor and the attorney general of Minnesota and the mayor of Minneapolis. The prospect of using federal charges as an intimidation tactic against local officials has real weight to it, and it has real consequences. While exceedingly inappropriate, at the end of the day, it is perhaps not on the first page, but it is certainly within the first chapter of the Authoritarian Takeover Handbook. So, why are we here? Currently, and appropriately, if a city official, from elected leaders at our level to a frontline worker, is charged with a crime, the city itself does not defend that employee or that official. This is important. It ensures that city employees and officials know that if they choose to break the law and are charged, that their defense against those charges is personal. That makes a lot of sense in a system that makes sense. But using examples, and you can make up any type of example you wish, but if a PBOT employee is working and told to drive a large piece of equipment down the road, but they do so while intoxicated, there's no place where the city of Portland should defend that person against the DUI charge. We all get that. Similarly, if an inspector takes a bribe while inspecting a recently completed project, the city is not going to defend those types of criminal acts. But earlier this year, we had a substantial debate about what documents the city administrator or the mayor could or should sign, and whether or not being the signatory opened them up personally up to personal liability or criminal charges, or for criminal charges. We as a council have enshrined our sanctuary laws, and we have, by that action, bestowed certain restrictions on our employees. If a parks employee refused to provide a participant name list at a recreation league to an ICE officer, they would be following our local laws, and they could potentially face federal charges. A police chief who does not authorize their officers to conduct missions with ICE could face federal charges. And this is not just a what if thought bubble. We are seeing this move from words of the last summer to threats in the new year and threats of action occurring in Minnesota. So I'm introducing this legislation that enables the city of Portland to defend either in actual or by paying for the defense of city employees and city officials if they face what the city administrator, the mayor, or the majority of council deem to be criminal or civil federal charges for simply conducting their official duties and for the purpose of intimidation. I don't think any of us on this dais, and certainly not most of our employees, can afford to spend a year or more of our lives defending against frivolous, trumped-up charges for intimidation alone. Going up against the feds would bankrupt just about everybody I know in public service. And that is why this type of intimidation is in the first chapter of the authoritarian reading. It is designed to silence, it is designed to distract, and it is designed to prevent state and local officials from doing their duties as bestowed upon them by the local leaders and local electorate who put them in office. And so I offer this up and I hope for your support. The crux of this legislation, since our legal department here at the city would not defend in practice criminal charges because they are not criminal defense attorneys, this is essentially a funding mechanism should it ever come to pass. In a perfect world, this will cost the city $0. In an unperfect world, we defend our people.
We can move into technical clarifying or council discussion questions. Councilor Maria.
I'm just trying to wrap my head around that because it is hard to, I'm just trying to wrap my head around passing an action, not knowing how much it will cost or the staff impact later, but I understand what you're saying. It's kind of a chicken or egg situation for this. Would this apply to city councilors also, out of curiosity? Do we count as employees?
Yes.
Okay.
From the mayor to whoever got hired this week.
Okay.
If the administrator, the mayor, or this council. And the reason, and that's an important point. Let me talk about that if you don't mind.
Yeah.
How can we expect that if a different member of the administration or of the legislative body picks up a charge that we think falls in this category? I think by having the mayor and the administrator and the city council as a checks and balances, meaning that I can reasonably understand why the city administrator may not want to make a determination about me as one of the legislative body if he did or didn't determine it to be for intimidation purposes. Okay, and so I think he should be able to punt, and he can punt to this body. And this body, by a vote of majority, my vote of 7, can say, yes, we do authorize the city attorney's office to secure the defense for a counselor. And then for our regular employees who are not up here on the dais, I think if the two of them are able to say, we think this was in their course of duties, we feel good that we are confident that they followed the laws, that they didn't do anything illegal by Oregon or by Portland law, and this is for the sake of intimidation, that at their level, they can make that determination. I think that's an important checks and balances here, but it applies to everybody who is a City of Portland employee.
Thanks for clarifying. I don't have any more questions right now.
Second question was around the sort of front end cost. And I think you probably answered most, if not all of this to Councilor Murillo, but when looking at the fiscal and budgetary impacts, minimal to modest, I think is fair. I wanted to ask in the context of, we had this conversation during the question about whether to allocate some money from that legal defense fund to SOAR, and there was a desire to keep that dollar amount above roughly $500,000 in there. It's your expectations that, given that we're at, I think, still 650 or 700,000 in there, that there's no concern about this threatening that, right?
Yeah, you know, I look at, I see the similarities because they come from the same fund, but I look at this as, this changes a piece of code for us to, it allows us to take an action, not just in this current budget, but in any year where the city council determines something has occurred. The discussion about when to tap certain reserve funds or contingency funds, I have always been one of those, like, my willingness to tap a fund like that early in the year versus later in the year, when it is directly or only kind of tangentially related to the reason in which that fund was established, I kind of see those as separate and different. Part of me says that if the goon squad rolled in here and arrested the chief of police, I don't care what the damn number is. And so that's where I think that it's almost about, are the numbers important or not? And I think when you're defending against this type of issue, and I look at this deeply as, I think this will be a piece of code that will never be executed, and I hope that's the case. But if it is, run the card. That's kind of my perspective. And maybe that lands poorly with some people, but I think that defending that that sanctity of the local government, of the state government, and that we are not one government at the federal level only. I just think that that matters. So that's why I haven't said, you know, to this amount or to that amount, because the largest law firm on the face of the earth is the federal DOJ. So,
which is under new leadership as of
which is leaderless, at least right now anyway. So we should understand that. That's why this could cripple an employee, a family, an elected official, or a city administrator. That conversation that we had last year in executive session about what our former administrator could or couldn't sign and whether or not he was or was not open to liability. And it wasn't just money types of liability, but criminal charges. That really made the hair that I don't have stand up. And so that's what I was thinking about, Counselor.
Counselor Coyama-Lane.
Thank you, Council President. Thank you, Councilor Zimmerman, for bringing this forward and for the work that your team put into this. I was sitting here looking at Robert Taylor. One of the games I play sometimes is like what you're thinking during meetings, and I also play it with City Administrator Lee. But I was just sitting there like, I wonder what Robert Taylor's thinking. And so just wanted to see if there's anything you wanted to add to this.
Thank you, Robert Taylor, City Attorney. I appreciate the item. I appreciate the discussion. Appreciate the thoughts around the budget impacts and how it might pay for it. I think it's a good idea. I hope we will never have to use it. And I hope that these times in our country pass soon. But given where we're at, I think this is a valuable tool to have. I view it as providing the city attorney's office authority to represent employees, and we currently don't have that authority. So this would give us the authority to do it or to go hire outside counsel to perform those services. And so for my part, I would like to have that authority so that we don't leave employees sort of high and dry in a very difficult situation.
You've been listening to an excerpt of the Portland City Council meeting from Thursday afternoon. Councilors passed an ordinance to use the city attorney's office to defend workers against retaliatory legal proceedings brought by the federal government. The vote was unanimous, with one absence. An emergency amendment from Councilor Tiffany Coyama-Lane passed, meaning the ordinance takes effect immediately. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. We begin with Trump's war. Now over a month old, the war in Iran is going badly for Trump. Some close observers are already declaring Trump's war a humiliating defeat for the United States. Trump will address the nation Wednesday night and is likely to declare victory is within reach as he sees his world collapsing around him. Downturns in the U.S. stock market, a spike in oil and gasoline prices and in inflation, allies refusing to cooperate in the war, and warnings about committing U.S. ground forces to combat on Iranian territory. Trump's unsupported claims, empty threats, and backtracking on reasons for attacking Iran have finally come to a head. They also raise serious questions about his mental state. Here are some of the latest signs. First, Trump said in a social media outburst that on one hand, the U.S. is, quote, in serious discussions with a new and more reasonable regime to end our military operations in Iran. Great progress has been made. But on the other hand, that, quote, if the Hormuz Strait is not immediately open for business, we will conclude our lovely stay in Iran by blowing up and completely obliterating all of their electric generating plants, oil wells, and Karg Island, and possibly all desalinization plants. Next, In an interview with Reuters, Trump turned 180 degrees on Iran's nuclear weapon capability. He said he does not care about the enriched uranium Iran still possesses, as it is so far underground, and that, quote, the big thing we have is they're not going to have a nuclear weapon, nor do they want one. Yet he also said the next president may have to deal with a nuclear Iran. Next, claiming that Iran has agreed to allowing 20 oil tankers to deliver to the U.S., then saying the U.S. doesn't need the oil. Next, direct U.S.-Iran talks have still not occurred, despite Trump's suggestions otherwise. Pakistan's government is trying to play mediator, and to that end, the foreign ministers of Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Egypt met in Pakistan over the weekend for 2 days of discussions. Nothing so far to indicate a peace plan that the U.S. and Iran would accept. Next, Marco Rubio's statement that the war will require another few weeks is in contrast with Trump's claim that the U.S. has already achieved regime change and, quote, didn't need regime change, but we got it because of the casualties of war. And finally, increasing ballistic missile strikes by Iran on Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, as Iran shows no sign of having depleted its missile arsenal. U.S. intelligence estimates the U.S. has destroyed only about a third of Iran's missiles, contrary to Trump's claim. It's not our war. Trump seems ready to dump Ukraine and NATO. The war on Iran has made Trump desperate to get rid of the Ukraine problem. According to President Vladimir Zelensky of Ukraine, the U.S. made its offer of security guarantees needed for a peace deal in Ukraine conditional on Kyiv ceding all of the country's eastern region of Donbas to Russia. Zelensky has consistently rejected such a trade-off. Trump has said that just as the Europeans have declined to assist the U.S. on Iran, the U.S. will not help Europe on Ukraine. Marco Rubio, by the way, says that Zelensky is lying. One thing is true, Trump's anger at NATO countries for not supporting his war. Spain and Italy have rejected use of air bases on their territory to bomb Iran. Britain is allowing U.S. bombing runs on a case-by-case basis. Trump's attitude is that while the U.S. doesn't need to rely on the Strait of Hormuz for oil, the Europeans must step up or suffer the consequences. NATO just wasn't there when he asked for help with the Iran war, Trump told a Miami Beach investment conference. They didn't want to get involved, and I believe that's going to cost them dearly. The Europeans' refusal, said Trump, was, quote, a tremendous mistake. We spend hundreds of billions of dollars a year on NATO, hundreds protecting them, and we would have always been there for them. But now, based on their actions, I guess we don't have to be. That's breaking news, he added for emphasis. Why would we be there for them if they're not there for us? In an interview with The Telegraph just the other day, Trump explicitly said, quote, I am strongly considering pulling out of NATO. I was never swayed by NATO. I always knew they were a paper tiger. And Putin knows that too, by the way. Memo to Trump. Only a two-thirds vote by the Senate or an act of Congress can pull the U.S. out of NATO. That requirement was reaffirmed in the National Defense Authorization Act of 2024. Russia is different, however. Like Trump, Pete Hegseth has harsh words for NATO, but says, quote, we don't need to air what Russia is doing. And what Russia is doing is helping Iran target U.S. bases and providing drones. Russia has also gotten a pass on the U.S. blockade of Cuba. The U.S. has allowed a Russian tanker to deliver desperately needed oil to Cuba. The White House said the tanker was allowed through the blockade for humanitarian reasons, but that U.S. policy on the blockade and on regime change in Cuba had not changed. The oil will give Cuba a few weeks of relief from its energy crisis. A new study of the damage caused by U.S. carbon emissions. The journal Nature has published a study in its March issue that for the first time seeks to assess the loss and damage to the U.S. and other economies caused by U.S. emissions. A unique feature of the study is that it calculates not just past damage, but expected future damage caused by past damage, plus future damage from future emissions, unless checked. That way of calculating illustrates not only how large loss and damages are due to fossil fuel emissions, but also just how difficult payments to settle losses and damage would be. The total loss and damage attributed to U.S. emissions since 1990 is around $10 trillion, with about a quarter of the total being damage to the United States itself. China is second at $9 trillion. Other countries affected deeply by U.S. emissions since 1990 include India and Brazil. Marshall Burke, a Stanford environmental scientist and lead author of the study, says, quote, "If you warm people up a little bit, we see very clear historical evidence you grow a little bit less quickly. If you accumulate these effects over 30 years, you just get a really large change by the end of 30 years. It's like death by a thousand cuts, and you have people being harmed who did not cause the problem, and that feels just fundamentally unfair." In other news, Trump will pay the French to abandon wind power. Donald Trump revealed the absurd lengths to which he's willing to go to prevent wind power from expanding in the United States. He will have the U.S. pay the French company Total Energy $928 million to stop offshore wind farm construction projects on the East Coast and use the payment for natural gas construction in Texas. Explaining the reason for accepting the payment, the head of Total cited the likelihood of litigation if it tried to contest Trump's order to end offshore wind projects. Lawsuits revealed Trump's illegal attempt to overturn climate change findings. In a lawsuit brought by the Union of Concerned Scientists and the Environmental Defense Fund, a judge ruled that the Trump administration had secretly and illegally brought together a bunch of climate denialists in order to issue a grossly faulty climate assessment. Government documents brought to light in the lawsuit showed that Energy Secretary Chris Wright had convened a climate working group that wrote a report specifically designed to undermine the EPA's endangerment finding, the central scientific support for warnings about threats to human health. That secretive group acted in violation of the Federal Advisory Committee Act of 1972, which requires open and transparent meetings when government policy recommendations are being made. Another lawsuit by the same two organizations seeks to force the government to reverse its elimination of the endangerment finding. Documents released by the administration under court order also reveal that the same climate deniers had also been tasked to prepare the next national climate assessment, which is sure to find that there is no climate crisis. Jakarta is sinking. Jakarta is Indonesia's capital and the world's largest city, with a population of 42 million people. About 40% of the city lies below sea level. The city is rapidly sinking, around 6 inches a year, due mainly to climate change and overdevelopment. It is estimated that nearly half of the city could be inundated and uninhabitable by 2050. Massive development projects starting in the 1970s led to exceptional use of water, resulting in very high subsidence and depletion of groundwater. As a result, the sinking city is victimized by severe flooding several months a year. As always, the poor living in shanties suffer most. Who is Mohammed Bagheer Ghalibaf? When Donald Trump and Marco Rubio insist that the U.S. is having discussions with certain Iranians, they may mean Mohammed Bagheer Ghalibaf, who some sources have identified as the interlocutor the Trump administration has worked with in the event Iran's leadership collapses. So who is this guy? The Guardian has written an unflattering profile of Ghalibaf that paints him as a hardliner hostile to the U.S. with a long history of authoritarian actions. Trump has again raised the Venezuela model to suggest that the next Iranian leader, hand-chosen by him, would be another Delcy Rodriguez, someone amenable to doing as directed by the United States. But the Guardian's analysis suggests otherwise. Quote, "In the pantheon of Iran's leaders, ruthlessly reduced by targeted assassinations, Ghalibaf stands out as a survivor. But if the U.S. president hopes he has finally located the Delcy Rodriguez of Iran, he may need to think again." Unquote. Ghalibaf has roots in the Revolutionary Guards, is a protege of Khomeini, and was involved in crushing anti-regime protests over the years. He would be another strongman ruler, but would lack the clerical credentials of Iran's post-revolutionary leaders. Venezuela's oil sector is open for business. Venezuela's acting president, Delcy Rodriguez, is showing that she understands the new post-Maduro reality in her country. She's trying to lure private investors to take over the country's oil production, assuring them of the safety of investments. speaking to potential investors in Miami at a meeting sponsored by Saudi Arabia, Rodriguez said the country's economy was recovering fast and would create conditions, quote, where investors know that regardless of political changes or restrictive circumstances, there is security, that Venezuela has laws that allow for the safe return of their investments. We are in a process of stabilization, she said, implementing the reforms needed for a productive environment and to attract investments that will diversify the engines of the Venezuelan economy, unquote. Washington is sure to be pleased with her words. The U.S. Embassy in Caracas has reopened. Israel imposes death sentences for Palestinians. The Israeli far right has pushed through a law that allows the death sentence to be handed down by military courts for Palestinians convicted of deadly attacks. Jewish settlers in the West Bank who commit the same crimes will not have to worry. The law isn't meant to apply to them. And I must mention No King's Day. Roughly 8 million people took part in around 3,300 rallies last Saturday, the largest in U.S. history. Nice going, America. Finally, two updates. First, the Trump-Xi Jinping summit is back on, now scheduled for mid-May. And a return visit by Xi later in the year is also being scheduled. Let's see if these trips actually take place. Both countries are accusing each other of violating fair trade practices with regard to their exports. Just as interesting as the Trump-Xi summit is a planned visit to China in April by the leader of Taiwan's largest opposition party, the Kuomintang, or KMT, at the invitation of Xi Jinping. The party has always advocated for much closer relations with China than the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, which Beijing consistently denounces. And lately, the KMT has prevented the government from pushing through a major increase in its military budget. And second, Russian oil exports have declined dramatically. It's been thought that Russia's war economy would greatly benefit from rising oil prices, but Reuters is reporting that its oil export capacity is down as much as 40%. Why so? It's the success of Ukraine's